vacancies or admissions.
Well, excuse me, we're opening up an informational meeting, invited testimony from the Health Services Commission. The chair asked me to run the meeting temporarily till she can return. We have people here that I know very well because I used to be on this commission for 10 years and chaired the last four. I feel kind of strange sitting across the table from them. But I'm going to ask them to come forward, identify themselves, and please give us your testimony. Now, I understand that at a previous meeting or testimony before this committee, which I was not present for due to other commitments, you had questions posed to you, which I expect you've brought back answers for.
Completely with, and I presented the staff with a full answer to all of those questions, and it's about a 580-page document.
Darren, I carefully read all that last night. Darren, you need to identify yourself for the record, and I did read the summary of it last night, or I did read the whole 500 pages, but please identify yourself when you speak, and we'll be all set, and go ahead and start your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name's, members of the committee, my name's John Santa. I'm the Administrator of the Office of Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research. Our agency staffs the Health Services Commission. I'm just here to introduce the presenters this morning. And we're fortunate to have two Health Service Commissioners here. On my far right, Eric Walsh is a family physician, has been on the commission for almost 4 years. He now practices at the Oregon Health Sciences University, where he directs the family practice residency program. He used to practice in Redmond. And Eric chairs the Outcomes Subcommittee of the Health Services Commission and has been involved in a variety of Health Service Commission issues. Next to Eric is Ellen Lowe, who I think many of you know from her many years of activity as an advocate for patients in a variety of different roles. Ellen has been on the Health Services Commission since it started. And to my immediate right is Darren Kaufman, who's the staff and staff director of the Health Services Commission. And Darren has been here, I think, almost since the start. And so is the world's expert on the prioritized list. I'll be making this morning's presentation. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Chair Bates, and for a little while, I'm used to having Dr. Bates as chair, so in my services on the Health Service Commission and other members of the subcommittee. I'm Ellen Lowe, and I am one of the consumer members on the Health Services Commission, and I will be presenting a little bit of our work to you this morning, and then followed by Eric Walsh. I, along with the 10 other members of the Commission, have been attempting to fulfill our legislative mandates during the last biennium through our maintenance and comprehensive review of the prioritized list of health services. And additionally, we're taking part in a much broader effort now to stabilize the Oregon Health Plan through the incorporation of severity guidelines into our list, the identification of treatments that are obsolete or should never be covered, and the definition of a standard benefit package that could be used to expand access to currently uninsured Oregonians. Going back to the very beginning, we have always had a practice of going out and doing listening. And so this wasn't just when the plan was initially put together. And I should correct one of the things. I was not one of the initial members. I came on the commission at almost the end of the first year. But during that first year, I chaired an outreach effort that was handled through Oregon Health Decisions. And so I can testify really as one of the citizens who participated in that first year to what began to be established and I would suggest is continued. And that's a constant mode of listening. The meetings of the Health Services Commission are always open, and I don't recall one single meeting in my years when we haven't had someone there wearing a citizen hat who has been observing us, and certainly we have been observed by a lot of the providers. During this last year, some of you came to some of the meetings that we held across the state, and you have been given a summary of those. I remember that Senator Yee participated in the one down at, I think it was Lynn Benton Community College, and I remember seeing Representative Bates at the one in Southern Oregon, and perhaps others of you participated too, because we did have legislative participation. And what I want to describe, which really you in some ways can't see in that report, is that these meetings were not the traditional sort of public hearing, but they were informational, and there were opportunities in small groups, and then most of us stayed around. We were there ahead of time, we were there afterwards, in a listening kind of mode. And so we heard a lot about the Oregon Health Plan, but we also heard a lot about Oregon's health care system. And so in a way then we became ears for other parts, both of the private and the public sector. I recall that Eric was one of those commission members, I think, who was made sure that he participated in as many of the meetings as possible. This last December, we had a new charge in which Governor Kitzhaber joined us and asked us to define a standard benefit package that is actuarially equivalent to that mandated under federal Medicaid law. This has not been a real easy task, or in some ways even a pleasant task for some of us, because we have a real pride in what we've put together. And Eric will talk a little bit about that. But we're also Oregonians, so we're realists. And so we have taken this task of beginning to define a benefit package that would be for the least vulnerable populations currently served by the Oregon Health Plan, and then use those savings to begin to expand coverage in Oregon up to 200% of the federal poverty level. And that's one of the things we really heard when we were out in the community, is that 100% of the federal poverty level does not become a livable wage for a great many Oregonians. The report that you'll be receiving will give a description of that work and the work plan, which will lead into the next biennium. So the commission really does recommend that this legislature, and I acknowledge that this will be something that will come out of a substantive committee, that you do pass some legislation that will allow Oregon to seek waivers so that health care can be expanded to at least up to 200% of the poverty level. And I'll turn now to Eric to talk about some of the medical part of what we do. But before I do that, I want to say that as a consumer member of the commission, what has been remarkable to me has been the generous participation of the physicians on the commission as mentors for us, and then I think mentors for the state as a whole. Eric?
I can't blush as red as your dress, but I'll try. I'm Eric Walsh. I'm the chairman of the Medical Outcomes Subcommittee, Health Outcomes Subcommittee. Andrew Glass, who's the physician, who's the chairman of the whole commission, is at his daughter's wedding today, and Darren said he would be excused for that, so I'm filling in for him. It's an honor to sit in front of you. I moved to Oregon from New York, and part of the decision behind that move was the inception of the Oregon Health Plan, and I looked forward to moving to a state which was so forward-thinking and compassionate regarding the health care of its citizens. So to come here and be a doctor in Redmond when the Oregon Health Plan was phased in was the first big thrill. The second big thrill was to be nominated to be on this commission, and that has been a tremendous privilege for me. So I want to report to you today on the medical things that we've done in the last couple of years, in the last biennium, basically falling into four categories, and then turn the microphone over to Darren and hope to field any questions that you might have. The first thing that we've done at its legislative mandate is the biennial review of the list, and this is done by collecting input from hundreds of subspecialists and specialists throughout the state. They look at the list in the diagnoses that involve their particular specialty and provide us input on whether the treatments are still useful, whether they're new things in the field, often there's input from more than one specialist. For example, broken bones might have input from emergency room doctors and orthopedists. And so the staff and the doctors on the Health Outcomes Subcommittee then take that massive information and try to normalize it and standardize it to the whole list and try to look at the list as a whole in terms of what changes might be made because of new medical developments or things that have been shown not to be useful. Then after that excruciating process, as Alan knows, we present our recommendations to the whole commission, and then there's a set of questions that they bring to the table as consumers and nurses and social workers, and from their different non-medical points of view. How does this fit in with the priorities of citizens and the money available and so forth? We do this knowing that HCFA is not probably willing to move the line, at least in its current and the way that things are currently set up. So it's a difficult process to try to move something up knowing that that moves something else down. The second thing we've done is interim changes to the list that we refer to as technical changes. There have been about 450 in the last 2 years. The vast majority of them involve changes in coding, which are truly technical. We used to code this as E1752, and now the new coding book came out, and they changed it to E1753 because something else moved into 1752. So that these are relatively minor technical changes, but it involves a fair amount of work. We've had an individual independent actuarial firm look at these changes we've made and assure us that they do not cause any financial effect that require a presentation to the Legislative Emergency Board or the legislature. So these are really non-financially important technical changes for coding and billing. We've limited these changes to every 6 months to make the paperwork burden on OMAP and the health plans easier. And we've limited the big technical changes that involve new technology, new treatment for hepatitis C, for example, to every year because of the same reason, that they require a lot more thought and input from actuaries and from the health plans and from OMAP. Thirdly, the commission has dealt with some complex medical issues, mainly involved in deciding what's experimental and what's new and tried and true. And the majority of these discussions have taken place around the issue of transplants, because there are always new organs to transplant and new ways to transplant them. And you're, I'm sure, aware of much of the publicity that's gone on around that. We see our charge as trying to balance our responsibility to individual citizens of Oregon with our responsibility to the whole population that's on the Oregon Health Plan. And those are tough decisions that are not as sexy as writing a story in the Oregonian about someone who needs an experimental transplant. as a response to that, we've developed an algorithm, sort of a decision tree, to use when requests for new transplants come up. And it involves the ability to actually find out how many of these transplants have been done to make some attempt at defining if they're really tried and true or if they're still experimental. The Health Services Commission was sort of burned by jumping on the bandwagon of a new stem cell transplant treatment for breast cancer, which, when the research was finally completed, turned out to be useless and very expensive. And the only study center that found a positive result was in South Africa, and it turned out that they faked their results. So we learned that lesson, I think, in terms of trying to deal with new issues, waiting long enough to be sure that they're tried and true and not experimental. Lastly, we have looked at the tremendous variation in practice, not just in Oregon, but throughout the country. There are procedures like hysterectomies, tonsillectomies, where the variation between communities of similar size and similar demographics are 8 to 10 times. So if you live in this town of 20,000, you're 8 times as likely to have your tonsils taken out as if you live in this other town down the road. Things like appendectomies don't have that kind of variation because everybody knows when you should have your appendix out. But other things have a lot of variation. And it turns out that actually looking at the entire nation, there are communities in Oregon that lead the list in surgery on the prostate and back surgery. I'm not going to name where those towns are, but those places are way at the top of the variation in how these procedures are done. So looking at that kind of thing, we've decided to work on doing practice guidelines, looking at the medical literature and trying to make some sense of this and suggest or maybe even impose practice guidelines on doctors that they have to prove that X, Y, and Z are present before the surgery is done. Mm-hmm. And that's a way of trying to standardize practice and make the list more coherent.
Eric, second, we have a question here.
Yeah.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Doctor. Your comment was very interesting, and I can remember my wife, who was a social worker, say that years ago she was saying she knew good and well if they went to certain doctors there was going to be a hysterectomy. That was just a given. So, and I'm just wondering, how is this information shared with the Board of Medical Examiners or the OMA? So people see this picture a little bit.
Well, nobody knows if the people who do 10 times as many are doing the right number and the people who do 1/10 are not doing enough. It's difficult to link this to licensure or report cards or quality indices at this point. If this is information from a thing called the Dartmouth Atlas, which started in 1982, looking at towns in New England, and now has studied the entire country. So the data is available to health plans, and the data is available to people to help them make informed decisions about their doctor. But you're absolutely right. Practicing in Redmond, I knew who to send somebody to if I wanted something not done or if I did want something done. The science is still catching up to the statistics, unfortunately, and it's hard to impose practice guidelines on providers because I'll speak for myself, it's hard for a doctor to admit that he doesn't know everything or that his style of practice might not be the standard of care. So we do this cautiously because we don't want doctors to be dropping out of health plans because we put guidelines. You know, it's a tricky situation. So we've developed 10 of these for 10 of the most common and most expensive procedures in the Oregon Health Plan where the variation is the largest. And so far we haven't heard too much negative feedback, but you can only go so far. You know, we're viewed as the bad guys, the regulating bodies, the people who create paperwork and all this stuff. So you can only take that so far before you start to get a backlash from the people who actually provide the care in the trenches. I don't Does that answer your question? I don't think there's really...
Yeah. Yeah. Duncan, let me give you a little more information. This may be helpful to you also. When you look at a community that's a small community, maybe has one or two doctors doing prostatectomies or four or five doctors doing back surgeries, and you see them way above the national average, it's easy to pinpoint that community and those physicians. You could also go down to Redding as an example in Northern California, and you'll see the number of bypasses being done there on hearts is much higher than the national average because one physician there is very, very aggressive in doing those. If you looked in Portland, you'd see more of the national average. But the reason is there's outliers all over the place in Portland, but they're washed out in a large number. Okay, so the real question comes down to what is the best practice for that type of illness? And medicine is still very much an art, not a science yet, although with guidelines finally coming out in the last 10 years, both from hospitals and from groups like this, we may see a convergence so there is some better sidewalls on this thing and people aren't out there practicing in areas which are very broad, very wide, with no real good scientific data for what the outcomes are. And that I think, will help hold down healthcare costs at the same time produce better healthcare. But physicians, my fellow physicians, are very reluctant to follow guidelines. I think they should, and many of us are advocating for those, but it's a slow process.
For example, some of the guidelines we used for women's health care came directly from the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. We have a respected member of the commission who's an obstetrician, gynecologist, and perinatologist from Medford who put his weight and his reputation behind these guidelines. And it's hard to argue with the guidelines from your own professional association, but they're logical, they're coherent, and they will help us to pull in some of the outliers a little bit, I think.
Madam Chair,
one
quick question. Do physicians have to report on the number of surgeries they do and so forth? Is that reported someplace?
Not that I know of. That ends my testimony. If we could answer, we could ask questions now or after Darren is.
I forgot to bring something up, Chair Winters and members of the committee. One of the process things that I did want to share with you, which I think came as a result of our facing folks coming to us with supposed expert testimony and really not knowing their full background, is that I don't think I've ever been part of a group where we have been more explicit about people divulging what could be a conflict of interest. And so that if they come to us with a request for including a new procedure as a treatment for one of the conditions, we really do ask questions and ask them to share with us what their conflict of interest might be. Most physicians and most providers who come to us really are much in the tradition of the physicians who have served on the commission, but there are some who are either a provider of a service or a good. So we do ask them.
Chair Winters, members of the subcommittee, for the record, my name is Darren Kaufman. I just wanted to point out that I provided your staff with a draft copy of our 2001 biennial report to the legislature that includes the newest prioritized list and gives some additional information on the topics that Ellen and Dr. Walsh have discussed here today. This report is actually going to the printer later this morning, and you will all be receiving bound copies of the report at the beginning of next week, Monday or Tuesday, so expect to see that. Otherwise, we're available for any additional questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Eric? Thank you for coming and appreciate your testimony. You mentioned the standards of various associations. In my modest little world of sort of a health arena, I find that the standards that the different associations promulgate sometimes are in excess of the practical needs of the everyday physician or perhaps even the surgeon. And wonder how you balanced out the ideal standards that one would certainly like to strive to if patients' money was no object versus what you could really do and what you, as experienced physicians, see and need?
That's a great question. Because professional associations want their members to have to do as much as they can. For patients, or sometimes two patients. My role as residency director is to model for my residents the ability to access evidence-based medicine that's unbiased by conflict of interest or by the sort of narrowly defined needs of professional organizations. So one thing that I think I've contributed to the commission is the ability to search the medical literature with all the resources that are available at OHSU databases and all that stuff, and look at the evidence that supports guidelines. And what we've looked at this, for example, with sleep apnea and whether the treatment that people get is really works. A lot of the really good literature in this area comes from overseas, particularly Great Britain, because they have a much more finely attuned sense of the trade-off between costs and benefits. And they have dealt with the issue of rationing for a lot longer than we have. So they look with a very cold eye at a lot of these things and come up with guidelines and with recommendations and with evidence that doesn't always fall exactly in line with the professional associations. I use the OBGYN as an example of an association who has recognized the need to be part of a team. In other words, to sink or swim along with other doctors in the healthcare systems and insurance companies and government agencies. And in order to swim rather than to sink, they've decided that it's reasonable to put some guidelines on their own members that actually make sense when you look at the evidence. That's not true with every professional association, and sometimes we've had to go to other sources of evidence to try to bring up guidelines.
Thank you. That's Chair Winters, Representative Schrader, if I could add something too. There's been a concerted effort to see that the physicians on the commission have a real broad base of medical knowledge. And they represent kind of general medical practices as opposed to some of the specialties. And you know, we've certainly seen cases where we've reviewed guidelines where basically if you walk into the doctor's office, you meet their guidelines for treatment. And I think it's that kind of broader ability of the physicians and the other members of the commission to look at, you know, what's a reasonable guideline and which one will really have an impact and really make sure that the resources are used in their best possible manner.
And that we can defend our decisions with evidence.
Right. I appreciate that because one of the concerns, you know, an average person or a lawmaker, if you will, has is that, you know, are we being thoughtful and rational about our decisions regardless of what seems to be the most protective practices or ideal practices?
Right.
I come up against that in my profession all the time. Similarly, long lines of diagnostic tests. I mean, I found that in my world, again, the cost of diagnostic tests is getting higher and higher, and I question some of my newer members of my profession as to the value vis-a-vis just some of the other things that you could do, and wondered how in the Oregon Health Plan we ration out the relative values of diagnostic testing. Certainly you have more liability than I do, although that's changing these days too, but wondered how you dealt with that.
Well, that's a great question. That's line zero, I think. That's the making of a diagnosis is line zero and is always covered. No matter if you order an MRI for a cold. We are pondering this issue. We see a clear need to address it. We don't have anything great to report at this point.
Representative Winters, or Chair Winters, Representative Schrader, this is actually something that we're currently looking at in terms of our work on defining a standard base benefit package. When the list was first put together, as Dr. Walsh mentions, the assumption is that you have access to a diagnostic test to determine what condition you may or may not have, and it's at that point in time that you go to the prioritized list and say, is further treatment for that condition covered or not according to the list?
but we've certainly realized that that there are there is overutilization out there in this area, and we think that that's a key piece that can be hopefully managed in some fashion to better use resources and to make this standard benefit package have a more reasonable cost associated with
it. Chair,
one other comment that I'd be interested in what Dr. Bates has to say too. But I think this is very, very, very important. In my profession, some of the newer members, I won't say hide behind, but there's some uncertainty when you get out in the big bad world and you expect to have an answer for every patient that walks in the your office. And the real world is you don't. I mean, I don't care if you're a physician or you're a veterinarian. You give your best educated guess, and sometimes it's easier than others. Most of the time, depending on how much money you're able to spend or willing to spend, you can get there. But then it becomes a point of diminishing returns. And I have a lot of my colleagues, I will say, well, so what? Your treatment, your available spectrum of treatment is going to be the same regardless of some of these conditions as you work down the diagnostic tree. So I don't want to, you know, I want to make sure we have high quality care. But at the same time, I would like to encourage men and women that have been in the profession for some time and understand the limitations of the diagnostics or the potential overuse of diagnostics to put some rationality in this, because I think that could be an area we could save a lot of money that could be reallocated to better health care for more people. That's the pitch that this panel has come across, I think, in this legislative session. How can we get more resources to more people? So I would really encourage you to look at that. I think that would be very important.
I think we're struggling with it. You bring up a very excellent point, and it's a tough nut.
Yeah.
Because how do you know what it's a circular sort of argument, but part of the answer, I think, is to put some of the medical decision making in the hands of generalists like Alan and me, who are more comfortable with uncertainty and who aren't supposed to be the final authority on the heart or the kidney and get all of the answers. And to some extent, that's worked in managed care, but we see the flat curve heading up again. And a very large part of it is, of course, diagnostics and pharmaceuticals. And we have to have some way to control ourselves about that. We just have to control ourselves. And we have a very hard time doing it.
I'll make a few comments about this situation, because it really is a difficult one. You may not understand if good Representative Schrader is a veterinarian. Yeah, so his client base is somewhat different than ours, although at times...
Sometimes.
You wonder.
In fact, I would add to it, I've had run horses all my life, and the veterinarians have more difficulty sometimes with the animals than you do with the human beings.
There have been times that I thought that I communicated better with my lab than some of my patients.
Yeah.
Probably my failure on my part. The difficulty of controlling cost as far as diagnosis is concerned is an extreme one. When we talk about high-tech changing the cost of medical care, a great deal of that is in diagnosis. What doctors do, I don't think, frankly, has changed hugely in the last 20 years. We do some stinting things on arteries and some other things that are new and different, but they're probably not hugely expensive. The real expense, as far as I can see, is in the high-tech necessary to make the diagnosis. Unfortunately, when you're dealing with human beings, the failure to make a diagnosis in that rare case is something that physicians fear for the patient's health, and they fear from the point of view of lawsuits, frankly. And if you look around the state with our huge number of new lawsuits coming out since we've lost tort reform, physicians are starting to practice, once again, severe defensive medicine. And that means ordering every possible test on the patient so you don't have a chance of missing anything. We know that if you go to a subspecialist for certain things, like let's say you go to a neurologist for a headache, you are going to get probably an MRI and a bunch of lab work that a generalist wouldn't order until he'd seen that your headache had not improved. The chance of him missing a brain tumor or something of that nature is extremely low because they're so rare. But you're going to find, I believe, that as time goes by, that the cost of diagnosis continues to climb as more and more physicians see their fellow physicians sued, or those type of pressures come on them, and I don't know how we're going to control it, really. You can set up guidelines when you use an MRI or when you use a PET scanner now, But I think those are going to be ignored to a great degree by the individuals, and the costs will continue to escalate. So it is a tough one you guys look at, but one you should.
Representative Schrader, sure.
To follow up that, what we've, in the veterinary field, what we've done, I don't know if it pulled up in the human arena, if you will, but there are standards of practice, and if one is practicing up to the common standards of practice commonly accepted by the profession for that particular disease condition, then you have some degree of liability protection should you be arraigned in court. Is that true in the medical field at all, or probably much less so, I'm sure?
No, it doesn't. I just tell you, I think it flat out, it means nothing.
Okay.
Yeah. It means nothing. And when you go to court, you're sitting in front of a jury of people who don't understand medical care, and whether you reached or surpassed or didn't maintain standard of care is really irrelevant.
Senator,
your vote last session.
Yes.
Senator Hartung, and then Cindy.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. This question is probably for the panel or maybe for the chairman. The Health Services Commission, brand new to me, because this is the first time I've been on the Ways and Means Sub on human services, but how broad is your area of interest, or my specifically, do you oversee, like I understand you do, the Oregon Health Plan, alcohol and drug programs, and the reason I ask this is because I follow right behind Representative Schrader on our interest in prioritizing. We don't have unlimited resources, and make sure that we take care of our people the best way we can. And you know, I'm really uncomfortable with a lot of the services that the DHS is providing. In my mind, and I know so little about it, it's probably not a fair comment, but it seems to me that that we're trying to do too many things in too many areas, and we're not doing them very well. And so, what, Madam Chairman, is there a commission similar to this that would look at these other services, health-related, of course, with the Department of Human Services?
Madam Chair, maybe I could answer that?
Yes.
I've had the same questions you've had in the last 4 months we've sat through this. Unfortunately, Health Service Commission is just for the prioritized list and the extra work this year of putting together a basic health care package. I don't know of any group that overlooks these. Well, the chair has talked to me several times about putting together an interim committee that would start looking at these agencies and asking the question, are your programs based on good outcomes, and are you getting the outcomes you need? And if you're not, why not? And maybe we should take a look at if those programs should be continued. That's something I'm very interested in. I think you're raising the question, which I think is an excellent question, on some of these agencies we've seen.
Yes.
Their own outcomes, which are questionable, even their own outcomes, which are questionable as far as the data is concerned, don't look good.
No.
We're spending huge amounts of money in these agencies, and the question arises, is it good use of our money? And I think it's something we need to look at in the interim. So I think the question you're asking is, do we have anybody looking us over? And I think the answer is probably no, and we probably should.
Peggy?
Madam Chair, I was just going to respond, as Dr. Bates did, that the Health Services Commission has a fairly narrow focus, and
okay.
That is dealing with the prioritized list of services in the Oregon Health Plan.
But I have begun to have this discussion of having an interim group to mm-hmm. look at some of these issues that have been raised during the course of the hearings that we've had.
And, you know, I might just say to that, and, you know, I think that's a good idea and we ought to do that, but my first session of the legislature was in 1967. And I've been on so many interim committees over the last 40 years that have, you know, we've studied and studied and studied, and really no good result has come from, I'd say, the majority of the activities of an interim committee. And it takes, you know, in my mind, it takes someone like Bobby Mink for us to say to him, you're the CEO, you've got to show results, and the results must be that the money is being well spent and we are taking care of our clients in the very best way possible, and that might even mean some rationing in some areas that we have not done so well. And I would like to see the interim committee, of course, but something more than that. Like a CEO, I don't know, what is the... Human Services budget? A couple hundred million dollars?
Billion.
Oh, no, 700 million, yeah, right.
7 billion.
Almost, yeah, right.
Billion.
Because the Oregon Health Plan is almost $1 billion now, isn't it?
Over two?
The human resources budget is, what, 26% of the overall state budget?
I mean, that is a big activity, and we're not managing it very well.
I would agree that if we had a CEO and that you do that, we're since we haven't got where we need to get on performance measures, and one of the discussions that I've had is that even though we have the Oregon Shine benchmarks, and you know, supposedly we're all working towards that, as we have talked to agencies, either the definition of what it means as performance outcomes and these kinds of terminologies appears to be different than what we say that we mean here on this panel. You know, and we want to tie those outcomes to their dollars. And I think we're making a good, you know, a good effort this session of trying to make sure that the agencies will be able to come back next session to where there's this linkage. And we didn't get it this session. But I think it's something that we should strive for. You know, Senator Yee has been right on target in putting people's feet to the fire, and I think we should continue to put their feet to the fire, and hopefully by next session, when they come in, whoever's sitting up here, that we will have done our job in such a way that they won't have struggled with the way we've struggled with getting them to try to respond to some of our questions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ben.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Yee's next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We certainly appreciate the Commission's work in prioritizing services. Every session, when we struggle with a budget to fund Oregon Health Plan, we like to adjust the prioritized services to match the available funding. So this is why federal government has given the waiver to allow us the discretion to adjust the prioritized services. I think last session we reduced 5 services in order for us to balance our budget. But federal government didn't grant that request, even though we have a waiver to do that, to adjust the services. So what is your anticipation this session that the Congress will respond to our request to adjust prioritized services to meet available funds?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, I think the Commission kind of shares in your frustrations with the recent inability to actually implement the Oregon Health Plan as it was proposed back in 1989 by changing the benefit package in relation to the resources that are available. During this last biennium, we certainly had many communications with the Healthcare Financing Administration in terms of providing documentation and outcomes information on it was actually 10 lines that were being proposed to be reduced from the benefit package during the last session. They had some particular concerns with certain health services within that 10 lines that we tried to convince them that they were down that far on the list because they are less effective at treating conditions than the other services that are placed above them. That's the whole point of the prioritized list. As you are aware, they did not approve that request for reduction in lines. We will certainly continue to support the legislature's decisions in terms of you know, making these reductions and trying to go to the federal government and try to lobby for your support in making those types of decisions, but we too feel that the
inability to move the line is a problem right now.
Follow up,
Madam Chair. Do you feel the new secretary in Health and Employment Services will be responsive to the state's request?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, we haven't had any discussions up to this point in time about any future possibility of moving of the funding line and what his or this administration's position might be on making such a change.
Follow up.
So I believe Governor Kitzhaber has a discussion with the new secretary. Have you had any information regarding the result of the conversation?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, I believe those discussions have been more around the proposal of the new possible waiver bill that's being presented at this point in time in terms of an expansion of the Oregon Health Plan as opposed to any potential reductions in the benefits under the current waiver demonstration.
So, Madam Chair, so more in the change in the co-payment and increase in premium for the new proposal?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, that's correct in terms of trying to manage the costs for some of the current eligibles in hopes to expand to additional uninsured Oregonians.
Would it not be an opportune time if we're going in for waivers that deal with the change in the benefit package and to talk about, expanding access, that it would be also time to look at the issue of removing the line?
Chair Winters, I think that it's probably appropriate to have those discussions in light of the new administration.
Maybe I can shed a little bit of light on some of these issues because I've been kind of in the middle of this. These discussions have been going on for the last 4 or 5 months. The original waiver did not allow us to have discretion to move that line. And the original waiver was granted only on the basis that we would have to have concurrence from HCFA to move that line. We did get a line drawn that was actually higher than most other programs in the country, but not as high as we wanted to go, and we did not have freedom to move the line. That was part of the original waiver, that we would not have complete freedom. What it did allow us to do is get rid of what we call categorials, which means that we could cover people outside of certain categories in the Oregon Health Plan. It also allowed us to go, at the time that we got the waiver, which I think was the first waiver granted, at that time Medicaid only covered up to 80% as a maximum, 80% of the federal poverty level. The waiver allowed us to go past that 80% feature. As a result, we brought about $400 million of federal funds into the state with no extra funding from our side over each biennium. So the most expansion of the Oregon Health Plan has been the basis of federal dollars. So we brought in more federal dollars, went above the 80% mark, and got rid of categorical so we could ensure a broader spectrum of people, and that's the way the plan expanded. But we did not get the okay to raise that line and where we wanted to, and it was something we've had to negotiate about every year to 2 years, and I've been a part of those negotiations, and it's been very difficult. They just refused to let us move a line. The group of physicians we worked with from back east were not inclined to look at what I would call practical changes, much as what Representative Schrader was talking about. It was sort of a Cadillac program for everybody or nothing. So it was a real battle. Right now is the time to look at that waiver again, and we'll be looking for a new waiver. That new waiver hopefully will have something tied into what you're doing, which is a basic package of health care, which will not probably be as rich as the one we have and will be more along the lines of commercial insurance. And that's what I hope you guys have been working on and have managed to come up with, because that's going to be a centerpiece. We're looking at legislation which will be on the floor today or tomorrow, which will be the vehicle, if we get the waivers, that will run everything through. And that bill came out of Representative Cruz's committee yesterday or the day before, and we'll be probably voting on it tomorrow. Senator Hartung has made, I think, an excellent point, and he's just left the room, about how to handle difficult agencies, I'll say. And I'll declare a conflict of interest here, because I'm going to talk about the Health Services Commission just for a minute, and I served on it for 10 years, was chair for 4 years, and and before that ran the subcommittee that Eric has now, so I'm very prejudiced. The Health Service Commission is one of the commissions that's done its job in this state and done it very economically. Everyone on it volunteers. It's a citizens committee made up of physicians who are actually practicing every day, and nurses, social workers, who are all active out there in the field and doing their job. That kind of oversight has brought reality to what they had to do. They were given a job of prioritizing health care, which had been tried in various countries around the world, never successfully done, but in fact was brought forward in 2 years, and now we have the prioritized list, which other countries are using and looking at. I think that the process the Health Service Commission went through is one we may want to borrow for looking at other agencies, so that next year when these agencies come back in front of this committee, and a lot of us aren't here because we've been assigned to different committees, and there's no continuity, we may want to think about not just an interim task force, but setting up a commission that is outside of those agencies that really overlooks what they do and potentially helps Bob Mink and people like that make some rational decisions about whether the programs are running are effective, whether they're looking at the right outcomes, whether the money is being spent appropriately. Whether that's something that is appropriate is something we probably could discuss in committee here. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sure.
Representative Schrader.
Just a couple of basic questions on the prioritized list, if I may. One would be, how do you deal with the differences in age of the people that are treated? Corner of the world, some treatments will, you're going to have better success in a younger individual than you will in an older individual, and indeed, for the older individual may actually accelerate their decline in a different way than the condition you're treating. Does age factor into the prioritized list in any way?
No. Representative Schrader, that's part of a larger question of how much we micromanage the practice of clinicians, physicians, nurse practitioners, physicians' assistants. And we have tried hard to avoid telling doctors exactly what to do. We've tried also very hard to figure out what works and what doesn't, and I think, and to factor public values and public input into that process. And I think we've been pretty successful. But we don't use any sort of clinical parameters to alter or make different lists for different ages or different.
Well, I understand. It is a bigger question, perhaps, but I would argue that, you know, frankly, the people we're talking about pay little or nothing for their own health care. And to do a lung transplant in a 70 or 80 year old individual is of dubious value, and that money that goes into something like that could be used for immunization for a bunch of younger individuals or to treat some other more serious conditions in young people where there's going to be a great chance in long longevity success.
Well, the guidelines for transplants do take age into effect, and those are professional society guidelines that we don't really need to muddle with. When there are 500 people waiting for lungs and 200 people waiting for hearts and 10 come up a year, I think in that case, we as generalists on the commission really are comfortable turning the decision of who gets them over to the specialists.
They'll probably make the appropriate decision.
Right.
Can I ask another question?
Sure, certainly.
Even more basic than that question is, what algorithm do you use to line up the slightly more either elective procedures or basic preventative health care procedures against more serious interventions necessary to treat more serious infections, perhaps even some treatable cancers? What's the algorithm you use to deal with that?
Well, we have categories of care that things fall into. I can refresh my memory just for a second, but at the top of the list is treatable fatal conditions. These are not in order after that, I don't think. But
yeah, no.
Maternity care, preventive care, third, family planning, fourth, comfort care, fifth, treatable non-fatal conditions, self-limited conditions, infertility services, and fetal care. And when you look at the list, the top 100, something like 90 of them are treatable fatal conditions as we define them. So it does they do fall out pretty well in the way they come out on the actual list. And we didn't do this like putting all of them in the top 100. That's just where they came out, and it was based on the way that the priorities were assessed. So when it comes to elective things, you might be talking about a hysterectomy. And the elective things are areas where we've really worked hard on the guidelines because they're often the most expensive. Another thing is prostate surgery. We have defined the amount of urine that has to stay in the bladder to justify prostate surgery, rather than just somebody saying, I don't like the way this feels. You have to have an objective finding. So those are the kinds of approaches we're trying to take with elective surgeries and elective procedures.
Thank you.
And I'm assuming that same approach is used for your hysterectomies, if there has to be some pathological...
Objective findings of blood loss, hemoglobin or hematocrit that has to fall below a certain level, a size of the lesion documented on ultrasound. So it's not just for discomfort or because my mother had one.
Because I think there were some studies done that probably more hysterectomies were done than probably was necessary. I can recall some of this discussion.
That's correct.
Particularly, I think, some of the endometriosis diagnosis. Am I correct, though?
Absolutely.
I think we're trying hard to look at these things. It's very difficult when you only meet every month and try to organize all this work into one day and then try to put it into a form that doesn't chase people away from taking care of poor Oregonians. It's a tough job.
I think you mentioned one time I was late coming in, but it was very intriguing, and that was the difficulty in dealing with the particular discipline and putting some standards or parameters around it. And I suspect that a lot of it goes back during their years in training at during their medical school and the godlike halo that occurs in that process. And I have to do a disclaimer. I worked at the med school for a number of years. So I think we're still dealing with some of those kind of self-importances. Is that what we're talking about?
Are you implying that I?
It does make it hard in the treating the medicine.
You are absolutely right,
Madam Chair. Yeah. You're speaking of surgeons here. those of us on the other side of the card have no problem that way.
Madam Chair,
I have to share a story with you since we said that. I worked in records, and we had and I was supervisor. And I had a record that had come from, had been in surgery, and the diagnosis was, of course, it came back disease unknown. And I contacted the doctor, and I said, all throughout your records, you know, and all throughout the x-ray reports and all this suggests that there was either a tumor or carcinoma someplace. Would you please tell me what happened when you went into surgery? And could you please give me a diagnosis? And whether the public, in a medical institution, records become very vital, and it's a part of the accreditation and all this. And so the doctor wrote me back a little cryptic note that said, only God knows. So I remember that all of the years. But that was a surgeon, you're right, God.
Well, Madam Chair, one of the things I've learned as a layperson is that medicine is not an exact science, and they don't have a better pipeline than some of us.
Senator Duncan.
Senator Hartung is not here, and he asked me to cover for him while he was gone, so I think I'd be derelict if I didn't just say, we really want you to take care of the elderly.
I, on the other hand, can cover the governor.
Representative Schrader.
No, I won't say that in public.
By the way, Representative Schrader's attitude will change through the years.
I know it will.
As he becomes chronologically advantaged, he will join this group.
Right. I just want to thank you for the work you do. It's a tough job, and when I first came to this body, I thought, well, geez, how'd they come up with this list? And I sure have better ideas than they do, you know, because I just
out there in
the real world. But I came to a quick understanding that that was probably not a good way to go, and members had been here a lot longer than I, that had the wisdom and foresight to realize having the real physicians out there in the real world dealing with things on a daily basis with their advocates and others that deal with these things is a much better way to do it than have a bunch of legislators, well-meaning albeit sometimes, other times not so well-meaning, interfere with that process. So I appreciate the work you do, and please keep it up. It's a great sacrifice, and it's great for the state of Oregon, so I really appreciate it.
I would just echo that, but I would also add that I think it is an opportunity for us to look at the line and the waivers since we're already raising the issue on other aspects. And if we're going to go forward and talk to director, the Secretary of Human Services, we might as well include those aspects or those elements that we think that would make the Oregon Health Plan a lot better.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two quick responses. The first one is that I would wager that any sort of waiver has a better chance of success if the legislature is unified in their requests. The second thanks is that the second observation is that looking at the legislature and what you all have to do in a short amount of time with education, roads, prisons, you name it, I often wonder how in the world you even scratch the surface of what you have to learn about. And I'm very actually reassured by the level of questions that you've raised today that, in fact, you do have a good understanding, at least of what we do. And in the areas that you don't understand so well, at least you can ask the right questions to fill yourself in. So that's it's been a pleasure to try to help you with that.
Well, I want to thank you, and I want to thank you for giving my colleagues the kudos, because I concur. This is an outstanding group of individuals that are here, and I couldn't have had a better committee coming through this session. And they do ask some very, very good questions, and they really are interested in the public policy of the not only your organization, but those that have come before us. And for the record, I am going to say that I think I've had probably the best group of legislators to assist me in this august task for this session. And I appreciate all of them. So if there's no further questions, I'm going to adjourn. And we can have a brief recess. I can't call the other agency up until 9:30.